Chapter 6. The Corporation as Steward. Chapter 6. Learning Objectives. After reading this chapter, you should be able to compare and contrast the responsibilities of fiduciaries and corporate stewards. Assess the impact on the environment and how a life cycle assessment can identify a product's, processes, or services' true cost to society. Describe government regulatory agencies in the United States, the European Union, and the global environmental movement. Introduction. In this chapter, we examine the notion of financial and non-financial stewardship and examine how the corporation can be a steward of people, profits, and the environment while managing and even repairing environmental impact and damage. Firms interact with and sometimes extract from and pollute the natural environment in multiple ways. Buildings use wood and metals from forests and mines. Companies require electricity from coal, wind, solar, nuclear, or other sources of energy. And computers use components from mines and fabrication plants. Firm employees who drive to work use energy and likely create pollution in the process. Manufacturing companies use natural and human-made inputs to create new products for sale. This chapter examines the relationship between the natural environment and the corporation. It addresses the environmental issues introduced in Chapter 5 and explores the true social, environmental, and financial cost of certain corporate activities. Part of addressing how companies relate to the environment includes discussing how they comply with legal regulations, best practices prescribed by non-governmental agencies and international organizations, such as the United Nations. This chapter describes analytical tools that allow people to identify risks, rewards, and impacts related to creating, using, and disposing products and services. These tools also provide data for companies that want to create less damaging or more restorative products. The discussion then turns to communitarianism, the green movement, and the formation of environmental regulatory agencies in the United States and European Union. It closes with a short discussion of how strategic concerns about risk management and human welfare issues related to water rights and water supplies may dominate corporate conversations going forward. Corporate fiduciary stewardship. Building on the environmental issues described in Chapter 5, this chapter examines the role and responsibilities of a corporate leader. Central to this discussion is a pressing dilemma of conflicting incentives that leaders in most publicly held corporations face. By definition, a publicly held corporation has multiple part owners who likely invested to gain a maximum return on their investment. Return on investment, ROI, is a tangible, objective measure of an investment's quality. ROI measures the amount of return relative to cost. To calculate ROI, divide the return or benefit of an investment by its cost. The result is a ratio that allows investors to compare different types of opportunities so they can evaluate the efficiency and effectiveness of each choice and select the most profitable or otherwise ideal option. Most publicly held corporations are expected to deliver a high ROI. Otherwise, investors will take their money elsewhere. By law, corporate leaders in public firms have a legal responsibility to provide a return on investment in both the short and long term. This means corporate leaders are required to manage trade-offs. Specifically, leaders of public firms manage the trade-off between protecting and restoring the environment, which can have costs that reduce ROI in the short term, and using the environment with less care in order to improve ROI for owners in the near term. A fiduciary refers to a person who holds a legal relationship of trust with one or more parties, such as shareholders. Typically, a corporate fiduciary prudently takes care of money or other assets. Corporate leaders, by default, become fiduciaries, or people with a special duty to owners and shareholders to protect and keep assets safe, but also efficiently and effectively use assets. By law, a corporate leader cannot profit at the expense of corporate shareholders. He or she can also be fired for not managing funds to maximize profits. In other words, leaders are morally and legally bound to seek profit on behalf of owners. Thus, fiduciaries are stewards or caretakers of the financial side of business. However, seeking profit for shareholders is not the only aspect of the complex notion of stewardship. Peter Block is a thought leader in the world of business who spent the past 40 years advocating for an expanded notion of corporate stewardship, one that goes beyond fiduciary concerns. Rather than just representing the interests of shareholders, Block advocates that corporations should adopt a stewardship model of management, whereby they treat people and natural resources as assets to be cared for, nurtured, preserved, and respected. Stewardship commonly refers to the responsible care and management of an asset over time that allows for sustainability and growth. Some argue that stewards are caretakers who balance all interests in the hopes of sustaining the life and value of an asset. For Block, stewardship is a mindset that changes the fundamental way corporate managers and leaders behave. Block suggests that not only are managers and leaders stewards of what happens within the corporation, they are also stewards of the corporation's social and environmental impacts. Block says that corporate leaders are responsible for ethical communication and for providing a quality good or service. He challenges corporate leaders to tend to environmental issues while simultaneously being fiduciaries of the financial bottom line. Block makes a compelling argument that most corporations act in immediate self-interest and do not have the capacity to balance long-term environmental needs with demands for short-term profit. Stewardship involves listening and weighing multiple interests, including long-term financial, social, and environmental interests, in addition to short-term financial ones. Religious, social, and environmental movements have long advocated the notion of stewardship over resources, which suggests that human and natural resources have intrinsic and long-term value and thus should be viewed with a long-term mindset. But Block's version of environmental stewardship suggests going one step further to restore environments. Such restorative behaviors include removing trash, planting trees, leaving nature as you found it, and actively caring for people and places. Stewards have a wide range of choices in how to act and may often feel squeezed between the short-term wants of people and the longer-term needs of future generations and place or the environment. According to Block, good stewardship often means choosing service over self-interest and creating long-term value over short-term gain. He suggests that stewardship can protect the earth from harm by making people accountable for the outcomes of an act or institution without forcing, controlling, or taking unwanted charge of others. In other words, good corporate stewards commit to the long-term well-being of their religion, society, and environment. They also recognize the interdependencies between four spheres. 1. Economy. 2. Livable community. 3. Social inclusion. 4. Governance. Regarding economy, a good steward attempts to take into account financial factors previously discussed, such as shareholder investments, expectations, and profits. But these interests can be best sustained within a livable community, one that is capable of providing well-trained and empowered employees who are able to lead healthy and productive lives. This means that good stewards attempt to practice inclusion by involving all stakeholders in communication, and they practice, submit to, and attempt to exemplify appropriate governance. In order to embody this view, good stewards consider and work across boundaries of jurisdiction, sector, and discipline to connect these four spheres and create opportunity for the region. It should be noted that people who are not necessarily corporate leaders are also considered stewards. For example, educators and students exercise important stewardship over society, the environment, and future generations when they study the world's various interconnections. Society also entrusts politicians and civil servants to be stewards of regions, resources, and people's well-being. Citizens can remove these privileges by vote or impeachment if government leaders do not practice stewardship. Owners can also remove corporate stewards, managers, if they are not acting in the corporation's best interests. In some way, we all have stewardship roles. To be sure, corporate leaders have macro stewardship responsibilities, but employees at all levels are accountable for many of the same issues. People who work for firms come face to face with stewardship issues if they waste resources, are asked to dispose of toxic waste inappropriately, take safety shortcuts, or lie on a financial report. Stewardship is a shared responsibility. To better understand our own stewardship responsibilities, it is critical to discuss the concepts of ownership and responsibility. Types of ownership and responsibility. There are many different conceptualizations of ownership, and different kinds of owners feel different levels of stewardship vis-a-vis the organization. The concept of private and transferable ownership lies at the core of most functioning capitalist societies. People in functioning capitalist societies typically understand that a person or entity who owns something can transfer that property to another person through a sale or through inheritance. A person who owns a piece of property or a company also has stewardship over that property or firm. Such stewardship can be formally transferred to another person. Essentially, ownership carries with it the opportunity to be a steward. In a totalitarian state, ownership of private property is disallowed or carefully controlled. This makes it harder to be an effective steward because owners usually have more power than other stakeholders. In communist states such as the former Soviet Union and contemporary North Korea, the concept of ownership is totalitarian, and the state owns most businesses and other factors of production. In contrast, the United States and European democracies conceive of ownership as a state in which assets can be held privately or by different government entities, including on national, state, and local levels. For example, governments may own transportation systems, such as Amtrak in the United States or British Rail in the United Kingdom. Many of the older European airlines, such as Air France, KLM, and Swiss Air, began as government-owned businesses. They have since been privatized or are semi-private, which means they are jointly owned by government entities and private companies. Partial ownership creates stewardship and legal challenges. It is difficult to determine who is responsible for performance when both shareholders and elected governments own part of a corporation. This state of affairs is further complicated when an owner needs to be held responsible by a court of law. When legal entities hold someone responsible for environmental damage, for example, it is difficult to prosecute or defend owners when the owner is the same government that manages the regulatory agency. Extending ownership and responsibility. When a corporate stakeholder sees a poorly calculated decision or one that has a negative environmental impact, it may not be easy for him or her to signal concern, nor are such warnings necessarily welcomed. It is clearly documented, for example, that engineers from the Morton Thiokol Corporation foresaw the failure of the Space Shuttle Challenger and tried, unsuccessfully, to block its launch. When the Challenger exploded on January 28, 1986, all 7 astronauts on board were killed. The first person to convincingly sound the alarm about social and environmental concerns, also known as a whistleblower, serves as an early warning system for the larger community. While many people think of themselves in the role of steward, many others believe they are powerless to change systems and organizations. However, this is not necessarily true, as many important voices have pointed out. Among them is former Czech Republic President Václav Havel, who was a political organizer during the Soviet occupation of his country during the 1980s. In 1985, he wrote a compelling essay about the powers of the seemingly weak. In it, Havel argues that even those in the most oppressive situations have power and responsibility to change the system for the better. Similarly, Margaret Wheatley, a thought leader in the world of business and an expert on complexity theory and leadership, believes that stewardship resides in everyone, regardless of the social and leadership environment in which they live. This stance illustrates how some people, such as Wheatley, consider individual workers and actors to be quite powerful. Such a mindset suggests that one need not wait to have a leadership position or be deeply experienced and highly credible to guide an organization to sustainability. Everyone has the capacity to be a good steward and advance the interests of the organization and the greater good. How can stewards at all levels of an organization take appropriate stances on critical concerns? By respecting, encouraging, and considering multiple voices. Extending the ideas of Havel and Wheatley, Max Dupree, the longtime leader of the Herman Miller Corporation, manufacturers of office furniture, publicly fostered the idea of an inclusive corporation, or one in which all voices are heard and given credence. He wanted to create a caring organization that was also financially successful. Because of that belief, he opposed business ideas that only benefited senior management. He suggested that good leaders and stewards are open to communication. But most of all, he was known for talking and listening to anyone and considering and enacting ideas from all levels of the company. Unlike Wheatley and Block, who were consultants and idea leaders, Dupree was a manager and a corporate actor. His ideas focused less on what a steward is and more on what he or she does. The cost of failed stewardship. Up to this point, stewardship has been described as both a mindset and a set of behaviors that can be distributed or enacted from inside or outside an organization. Equally important to cover are stewardship failures. Indeed, examining failures creates another way to motivate action. Most instances of failed corporate stewardship go far beyond harming financial stakeholders. Such failures impact the social community, the environment, employees, the legal system, and the banking system. For example, The potential failure of the U.S. auto industry in the 2008 recession triggered Congress to offer massive financial aid to top manufacturing companies. The subsequent financial bailout was justified for a variety of reasons, including to preserve jobs and national security. However, the same bailout cost taxpayers, cost the firms in reputational capital, and cost citizens and investors stress in terms of uncertainty and fear. What are the additional costs when stewardship fails? These can be seen in the blunder by Atlas Minerals, a now closed industrial site near the entrance of the Arches National Park in Moab, Utah. Driven by a demanding client and a perceived threat, members of management did not consider the longer-term environmental impacts when they decided how to mine and store uranium. Atlas Minerals was not considering sustainability, which involves meeting the needs of the current generation without compromising the needs of future ones. Arches National Park is a tourist destination for visitors from all over the world. They come to see beautiful red rocks that have been hollowed by wind erosion. But in contrast to these natural wonders sits Atlas Minerals. When Atlas operated between 1960 and 1990, it stored large piles of tailings, or leftovers, from the extraction process from the region's uranium mines at the edge of the Colorado River. The Atlas Minerals mine and industrial site primarily provided fuel for the nation's nuclear reactors and helped create fuel for nuclear weapons used to defend the United States. As the need for uranium dwindled, however, scientists and the general public learned more about the toxicity of the uranium tailings. Not only was the dust from the tailings contaminating the population near Moab, but water seeping through the tailings was also flowing into the Colorado River, Lake Powell, and the Grand Canyon. What was once thought of as an acceptable risk and normal byproduct of manufacturing was finally seen as an environmental disaster. With such discoveries and related changes, Atlas Minerals entered Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and in doing so, dodged liability for undertaking a massive cleanup that cost many times more than the company was worth. Since then, the DOE has taken over the site and is now tasked with cleaning up all such sites that contributed to pollution related to the creation of nuclear weapons. After the DOE assumed ownership of the land, it set up a trust to fund the site's cleanup. As of 2016, only 50% of the tailings had been removed. Trainloads of radioactive tailings are continuously removed from the site, about 5,000 tons each week. The tailings are taken approximately 40 miles away to a location considered less environmentally sensitive because it is not at the edge of the Colorado River. The project will cost taxpayers many times the amount that Atlas Minerals made in profit during its years in production. In fairness, corporate leaders who in the 1950s endorsed the plan to build a uranium mill and store tailings near the Colorado River did so with the approval of, and even encouragement from, government agencies. They operated using the best science of the time, although there were environmental engineers, local workers, and others who could see the folly of putting a radioactive tailings pile so close to the Colorado River. However, their concerns were dismissed, ignored, or discounted. For the sake of short-term cost savings and expediency, and due to a narrow definition of impact, a river was polluted, the life expectancy of nearby humans and animals was reduced, and the cost of conducting a massive cleanup was passed on to taxpayers. In contrast, corporate leaders of today and the future, especially those who take a stewardship mindset, research the impacts of location, sourcing, and product ingredients on current and future generations before making decisions. If we agree with Havel, Wheatley, and Dupree, then most, but not all, of the blame goes to those who own the corporation. The bad planning, failed science, poor execution, and bankruptcy are not just the failure of corporate leaders, but also of regulatory agencies, government, and even local citizens and employees. We all share in the blame for poor stewardship if we are connected to a community. But as problems get larger and involve more stakeholders, it becomes increasingly difficult to reach agreement and take collective action. In addition, it may seem difficult to foresee the impacts of large-scale corporate activities on future generations. However, several tools can help assess the environmental impact of a product, process, plant, or any other activity in which an organization may engage. One is the Life Cycle Assessment, LCA, which provides a way to measure a corporation's environmental impact and includes energy costs and material usage information. An LCA describes the process of evaluating the social and environmental implications associated with creating, consuming, and disposing of a product, process, or activity. The LCA allows corporations to examine waste, reduce costs, and innovate products and services. In other words, it can lead to both short-term and long-term fiscal and environmental benefits if firms utilize its data to innovate. It is often assumed that LCA projections are approximate and should be adjusted when more exact information becomes available. However, leaders should not avoid LCAs or leave them half-finished due to lack of perfect information. Instead, leaders should make solid assumptions, state what these are, and continue with the LCA process. LCAs can be extensive, comprehensive, and therefore costly, depending on their level of detail and accuracy. But they can also be enlightening, even in their simpler and less expensive forms. Whether extensive or simplistic, such analyses evaluate energy inputs, environmental emissions, and the social implications of business operations. In contrast, the cost of not doing an LCA can also be extensive, as seen in the Atlas Minerals case. It can result in firms mistreating stakeholders, wasting resources, incurring internal expenses, or receiving bad publicity. Running an LCA would help managers identify and address weak spots and risky areas. When managers do not assess impacts, they may fail to see risks as well as opportunities to evolve products to mitigate environmental and social impacts. For example, after performing an LCA, Levi Strauss & Company implemented changes to mitigate the environmental impact of its jeans. CSR and Sustainability in Action, Levi Strauss & Company. An LCA done by Levi Strauss & Company in 2016 showed that approximately 1,003 gallons of water are used to make a single pair of jeans. Producing the material accounts for 680 gallons, and the washing and cleaning of machines and manufacturing facilities account for the rest. Almost 70 pounds of carbon dioxide are produced to create each pair of jeans, mostly during fabric production. The LCA, which follows the product from birth to end of use, also found that Americans wash jeans, on average, after wearing them 2 times. Europeans wear them 2.5 times, while Chinese wear them 4 times before washing. The LCA suggested that if consumers wear their jeans 10 times before washing them, they could reduce the environmental impact of jeans by 77%. Using cold water and air drying them would further reduce jeans' environmental footprint. Using these findings, Levi Strauss implemented the Project WET Foundation to train employees to save water and educate others on ways to conserve water. The company also used the LCA results to partner with Goodwill and implement a special tag on Levi's products, encouraging consumers to consider the planet before washing the item. The tag also suggested which wash settings to use to reduce environmental impact and encouraged those who buy jeans to donate clothes rather than throwing them out. Because of the LCA findings, Levi Strauss found innovative ways to reduce its products' environmental impact and encourage others to become stewards of the environment. The LCA process. While there are several different approaches to undertaking an LCA, the cradle-to-grave assessment, the approach used by Levi Strauss, offers comprehensive data and is most accurate because it looks at the complete process of making a product. Cradle-to-grave is a term that refers to the time from initial manufacture or birth of a product or service to its disposal or death. The cradle period for a car, for example, involves the extraction of metals, chemicals, and minerals for car parts and electronic components, and the extraction of petroleum for plastics and the gasoline or electricity that will power the car. Performing an LCA for a car also means considering its end-of-life destination, which for many cars is either a junkyard, a landfill, or a recycling facility where some or all of the parts are extracted and reused. As another example, consider the cradle-to-grave LCA of a newspaper. Harvesting and grounding trees into pulp is an energy-intensive process. Paper is produced from the pulp. The paper is shipped to suppliers and then sent on to printing facilities that print ink on it. The same facilities fold and prepare the paper to ship to vendors. The paper is then delivered to homes and offices in cars and trucks that produce pollution and are powered by fossil fuels. At this point, the paper has left the cradle stage and is now moving through the life stage where it is consumed, red. It is then disposed of and heads toward the grave stage. Newspapers, those that still exist in this digital age, can be burned, used as wrapping or protective cover, be recycled, or thrown away to decompose in landfills. The impacts of each grave can also be analyzed. If papers are recycled, one possible outcome is to create cellulose insulation, which can be installed in homes and offices. It is also possible to calculate the fossil fuel savings from the insulation, along with the effects of most other steps in the life cycle. Conversely, if the papers are burned, then the release of carbon can also be measured and assigned to the product LCA measurement tally. When recycling costs and benefits enter the picture, some people suggest that the LCA becomes a cradle-to-cradle analysis. Cradle-to-cradle was discussed in Chapter 5.3. The term was coined by design advocate Bill McDonough, who suggested that when the output of one cycle can be the input for another cycle, the materials need never enter landfill or junkyard graves. When the process of making and using a newspaper ends with landfill expenses and impacts, then the analysis is a cradle-to-grave analysis. If, however, the analysis includes data on recycling and finding alternative uses for the product, then it begins to resemble a cradle-to-cradle analysis. Note that there is an entire industry of firms and practitioners interested in conducting LCAs. As these needs have increased, so has the need to standardize and develop processes that enable comparisons and ensure accuracy. there are widely accepted standards in place that are managed by the International Organization for Standardization, ISO. Specifically, standards such as ISO 14040 and 14044 explain how to conduct LCAs. Both sets of standards recommend that the process include four distinct phases, as illustrated in Figure 6.1 in your text. These phases, or steps, are interdependent, which adds to the complexity of the analysis. Further complicating matters is the back-and-forth nature of this process, where, for example, changes in goal and scope impact inventory analysis, and changes in inventory analysis impact goal and scope. Phase 1. Goal and Scope. An LCA begins with a statement of scope and a goal for the study. The statement establishes the context for the study and explains what added value to expect from the project. It gives the project a framework, purpose, and context. Some managers might want to do an LCA to understand carbon-related issues, while others might want to understand labor, landfill, or water use concerns. Thus, all parties need to agree on the scope and purpose of the LCA at the outset. The goal is both general and specific. It is general because it lays out the study's boundaries. It is also specific because it includes the technical details that guide the subsequent work. The goal and scope statement describes the functional units being studied, the system boundaries, the study's system limitations, and the impact categories that have been chosen. System boundaries comprise the limitations of the study, and the boundaries different managers choose can vary from company to company or product to product. For instance, in the Levi Strauss example, the company defined the system by looking only at production of the 501 model of jeans, thus limiting the study to one style. That study's impact categories are also clear. Analysts looked at water usage and carbon footprint, but did not look at other impacts, such as hazardous waste. Phase 2. Inventory. The next phase of an LCA involves creating an inventory of all relevant inputs, processes, and outputs related to a good or service. For example, an LCA can apply to a cup of coffee, a sweater, or a consulting assignment. Inputs may include energy, water, materials, and labor. They might also include required plants, factories, and equipment, including land. This part of the study examines all of the things that go into making a product or providing a service or creating a process. The inventory also includes outputs, and analyzing these involves answering questions such as, what specific products or services are provided? What waste is created? What pollution is created? What secondary benefits, such as recycled newspapers becoming insulation, are created? What is the value added when this product comes into existence? All of these data are needed to create an illustrative flowchart of the entire production process and the relevant supply chain. If done correctly, inventory analysis yields a complete list of all activities within the system boundary, including the supply chain, the inputs, and the outputs. The inventory analysis also provides a clear map of all the activities in the production system boundary, giving a clear picture of what data can be presented to analyze the production and distribution system. The LCA shows how inventory flows into the system, how it is changed, how it leaves the production system, and what value is added or destroyed along the way. Phase 3. Impact Studies. An impact study searches out data to quantify the expense and impact of each step in the LCA. This phase of the LCA is designed to evaluate the significance of social and environmental impacts based on the system flow, how a product or service moves through its life cycle. If you are going to complete an LCA, begin with the following questions. What are the impact categories? Water usage, carbon footprint, landfill space and cost, mining activities, human toll of mining, fossil fuel use, and so on. What model will you use to measure impact? Cradle to cradle or cradle to grave? How will you classify each stage of production? Where and how are the inventory parameters sorted and assigned to specific impact categories? What is the impact measurement? Will it be in dollars, carbon output or usage, or some other unit of measure? What is the overall impact category total? What assumptions are included in that number? Data validity is an ongoing concern for LCAs because processes change regularly, as does the environment. Data must be accurate and current. Common metrics must be used so that data between systems is fair, accurate, and comparable. There are two types of LCA data. The first is unit process data, which is determined from direct surveys of companies or plants that produce the product of interest and is carried out at a unit process level and defined by the study's system boundaries. Unit process data is the actual cost of producing a single unit, not just its monetary cost, but its cost in gallons of water or carbon consumption, for example. The second type of data is environmental input-output data, which is based on national economic input-output data rather than data directly from company sources and instruments. Sometimes an analyst will need to use mixed sources. If this is the case, it must be stated in the report. Of course, it is ideal to gather all data from the same type of source. However, at times, it is better to use mixed source data than to ignore or omit data. Phase 4. Interpretation. The interpretation stage of the LCA is important and represents the most subjective stage. In this stage, the analyst or team of analysts assess and decide whether some impacts are good or bad, value-adding or wasteful, and then determine how to compare such results to baseline or competitive data. In this step, analysts return to the study's goals and consider the intended users of the results. They then make reporting and summary decisions accordingly. As with the entire process, the best way to protect the integrity of the process and its results is to state assumptions in footnotes or the body of the report. Consumers of the report can decide for themselves whether they want to rerun the report or parts of it based on different assumptions or whether the assumptions hold as more data become available. The value of the LCA. With sustainability and social responsibility as goals, stakeholders are looking for ways to understand how our collective activity impacts the course of humans and nature. The reports and assessments relate to CSR because they represent concrete ways to analyze the actual resource-level impacts of a company or product. LCAs offer those interested in CSR a tool to analyze, compare, investigate, and measure corporate behaviors. LCA reports conducted over time and based on raw data also allow those interested in CSR the opportunity to analyze long-term improvement or decline in a more objective manner than is offered by assessments based on public opinion. An LCA is an excellent conceptual tool that is used both nationally and internationally to study the impact human systems have on natural systems. In this way, an LCA is both an environmental and social CSR tool. An LCA offers a narrow view of how one set of activities impacts one part of nature. Organizations such as the American Center for Life Cycle Assessment have created larger databases that offer a more complete picture of the life cycle costs of various processes. As people continue to conduct LCAs and contribute to databases, the impact, trade-offs, and valid or invalid assumptions will grow increasingly clear and useful for CSR and sustainability practitioners. The value of pursuing an LCA lies in the fact that considering linkages and impacts enables managers to see connections and possible risks in time to take action. An LCA provides stakeholders with data on how some aspects of the company impact the environment. It also provides government and regulatory agencies with data they can use to create or avoid legislation. An LCA can reveal where firms can expect problems and reveal places to focus on in terms of innovation, resiliency, or alternatives. For instance, in the Levi Strauss example, the manufacturer recommends washing jeans less often to reduce water usage and thus minimize the product's carbon footprint. As another example, consider an LCA that Procter & Gamble, P&G, scientists performed on Tide laundry detergent. In doing so, they learned that the greatest impact on the environment was not from the manufacturing process or the product's chemicals. It was also not from shipping and disposing heavy plastic bottles and paper boxes around the country. Rather, the heaviest environmental impact came from customers using hot water to use the product. Depending on the cost of fuel and energy, the environmental impact of using electricity or natural gas to heat water can be quite high. P&G could have given up on the goal of stewardship and sustainability by pointing out that the greatest impact of laundry soap came from user behaviors, which is not under the company's control. Instead, however, P&G chose a more innovative path. The company reformulated the detergent to be effective in cold water and found that doing so increased market share and profits while decreasing the product's environmental impact. The example of P&G working with LCA data to create a better and less damaging product reflects how LCA relates to resiliency and social responsibility. Resiliency. The concept of resiliency is typically treated as an individual quality. It is often regarded as a personal and psychological characteristic of a strong person who can bounce back after setbacks and difficulties. But resiliency is also an important characteristic of strong communities and of sustainable systems. In nature, resiliency describes an ecosystem's capacity to absorb a disturbance and still maintain its basic structure and viability. The system theory makes resiliency more difficult to attain because it suggests that in an open system, we cannot control nor see all of the aspects that impact an area of stewardship. That said, resiliency remains a valuable characteristic in an open system because a more resilient, open system is more able to adapt to change without catastrophic impact. For example, in 1988, a wildfire burned 36% of the trees in the Yellowstone National Park ecosystem. U.S. Forest Service policy demanded that workers quickly put out the fires, and news coverage suggested that Yellowstone might be destroyed. However, fire is part of any forest's life cycle, and thus, wildfires are part of its longer-term and resiliency story. The resilient forest sprouted millions of new trees in the next season, trees that could only sprout under intense heat. And 25 years later, those trees form the habitat for many resurging species of birds and small animals. Just as maintaining a forest requires accepting natural periods of stress, wildfires, that result in a stronger and more resilient ecosystem, humans and organizations can also build resiliency. In building a sustainable organization that has a strong relationship with social, governmental, and environmental partners, resiliency is the desired characteristic. One of the most extensive discussions of resiliency in the history of mankind pertains to global warming. The notion of sustainability combined with the idea of resilience forces a discussion about how much our human systems, including corporations, governments, militaries, and agricultural practices, can impact planetary ecological systems. The threat from global warming raises many questions, including, how much of an assault on resources can our planet take? What is the impact of human activity on global water and air temperatures, and thus on climate, water levels, weather patterns, and long-term survival? How much do human-constructed systems impact natural ecosystems? How can policymakers, government, and international organizations impact human behavior in order to reduce the footprint on the natural environment? The answers to these questions are still under investigation, and exploring the available data is outside the scope of this text. In terms of social responsibility and sustainability, current and future leaders and consumers need to know that these questions matter at the highest levels of management. The search for answers continues, but as data emerges, the implications vary for different industries. Thus, leaders must train themselves to ask the questions, request the data, and analyze it to enable action. Whether that means innovating, like P&G, taking responsibility, ceasing or transferring activities, like Atlas Minerals, or co-creating solutions with communities and stakeholders, like Levi Strauss. Being resilient can also drive business opportunities. The Honest Company, the eco-friendly consumer products manufacturer founded by actress and entrepreneur Jessica Alba, is valued at $1.7 billion. Alba suffered asthma-related allergies that affected her in childhood, and she worried that her baby would suffer the same plight. She therefore launched The Honest Company to create products free of toxic chemicals and artificial ingredients. Alba has been on the cover of Vanity Fair as Founder of the Year and has been listed by Forbes as one of America's richest self-made women. Her estimated net worth is $200 million. This success shows how the quest for sustainable business and resiliency in both humans and corporations can be good for the environment, consumers, and the firm. It also underscores how understanding and cultivating resiliency for both economic and natural systems is one of the single most important questions and sources of opportunity for upcoming generations. Alba wanted children to be healthy, a form of resilience, and she wanted her firm to stand for health and sustainability. Apply your knowledge. Perform an LCA. Draw a map that represents the LCA of a common product. Include all inputs, processes, and outputs. Consider the outcomes of the LCA. What are some suggestions you could make to reduce the product's environmental impact? The cooperative culture. There is at least one philosophical school that attempts to explain the relationship between humans, their social systems, and nature. Communitarianism. As the name implies, communitarianism describes a philosophy that emphasizes community, or the association and affiliation of entities at individual, social, and ecological levels. As a philosophy, communitarianism forces us to look at our relationship with others. It requires knowing how individual behaviors affect others, including families, neighborhoods, communities, and countries. Particularly when applied to corporations, a communitarian philosophy constitutes yet another element of sustainability. In order to become stewards of sustainability, we must see and understand our impact on others, the environment, and the government. One route to creating a more sustainable world is for corporate actors to adopt the mindset of communitarianism. Communitarianism poses questions about how we relate to each other and makes us inquisitive about the relationship between the firm and other people, groups, cultures, and the environment. In the communitarian world, resiliency is achieved when individuals, corporations, and other entities can absorb a disturbance and still maintain basic structure and viability. In some ways, communitarian ideals sparked the green movement in the United States and internationally. The Green Movement in America. The early environmental movement in the United States embodied many tenets from communitarian ethics. Literary figures from the 19th century, such as Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, often wrote about the value of wilderness, nature, and the environment in laudatory and venerating terms. They suggested that these natural creations were gifts. They were even a means by which humans could access the divine. These ideas were a form of practical communitarianism that emphasized resilience and sustainability. Many people were influenced by these ideals, and thus it became popular to believe that humans need nature for a variety of reasons. As these ideas took hold of the national consciousness in the 19th century, the eastern United States was being rapidly dominated by human consumption. The Industrial Revolution pushed non-agrarian business further west, eliminating the wilderness. As a result of these and other influences, the United States created the National Park Service to preserve and protect the natural environment. For example, Yellowstone National Park was created in 1872 to preserve that unique ecosystem from the exploitation underway in other parts of the West. Later, other national parks such as Yosemite, Grand Teton, and the Grand Canyon were created. Visionary leaders like John Muir and Theodore Roosevelt were associated with this movement. These people gave voice to the wilderness, nature, trees, and the ecosystem. Treating nature and green space as valuable and worth preserving for future generations is a key hallmark of what is called the Green Movement. A key goal of this movement is to preserve parks, and other goals stem from that premise. The Green Movement has not been without controversy. There are some political groups that claim environmentalism is tied to a political party. Others want to repudiate it because of this very association. However, environmentalism is an issue shared by multiple political parties and people of different races, genders, and socioeconomic status, and it has taken various forms over generations. Whether environmental issues are politicized or not, they affect many people at a deep and visceral level. When people care deeply about preserving nature and the environment, they often formally organize in favor of some kind of change, or against change in some cases. The next sections of this chapter look at organizations and activism within communities at the local, national, and global levels. Organizing in and for local communities. Communities usually face environmental issues that are unique to an area's geographic and ecological composition. While national and state governments seek to regulate corporations and mitigate impact on the environment, local communities in which businesses operate often live with the consequences of those regulations. Consider again the example of Atlas Minerals. For example, environmental regulations may inhibit local economic growth, such as when a protected species inhabits land that farmers traditionally cultivate, or loggers desire to harvest. Irresponsible behavior by local corporations may also negatively affect the local population's health, damage property values, and reduce the economic viability of a particular area. The Atlas Minerals example describes a major environmental problem at the Grand Canyon, one of the most attractive tourist destinations in the United States. Local leaders initially denied the problem and then tried to blame it on the corporation. Eventually, they were grateful that the federal government stepped in to mitigate the situation. However, such intervention is not always possible or viable. Certainly, some environmental problems have multiple causes and broader effects that require multi-sectoral, even international, commitment to address. The International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. Many local governments have become frustrated by the inability of state and national governments to quickly and appropriately address local environmental issues. One way to cope with such frustration involves organizing and partnering with others in similar situations. In 1990, the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, ICLEI, was founded as an international organization of local governments committed to sustainable environmental practices, including sustainable community development. The membership focuses on education and advocacy to encourage corporations to implement sustainable practices into their corporate culture. Today, more than 1,000 towns, cities, counties, and regions make up the ICLEI's growing membership. The ICLEI advocates that local governments work through international performance-based results-oriented campaigns and programs, such as the LCA described earlier in this chapter. Yet the ICLEI does not work directly with corporations. Instead, members network with and support local governments in solving environmental problems through consulting and education. In other words, the ICLEI encourages local governments to form collaborative relationships with corporations to mitigate the economic effects of government environmental regulation while protecting the health of the environment and the population. The ICLEI is an excellent example of how the environmental movement has promoted the idea of thinking globally but acting locally. The existence of such an organization underscores the importance of corporations having an environmentally themed dialogue with the communities in which they operate. Corporations that operate manufacturing plants and factories leave the largest impact in the communities in which they operate. Ignoring these impacts and the resulting behavior is no longer acceptable, nor is it advocated by corporate leaders who are themselves often environmentalists. national organizations, and activism. Environmental problems are often difficult to see without scientific investigation, and especially difficult to address without support from industry, corporations, nonprofit advocacy groups, and citizens in partnership. Most nations have empowered a government agency to oversee and enforce environmental regulations. While the strength of such agencies varies from sovereignty to sovereignty, it is clear that with each passing generation, environmental regulators are increasingly stronger advocates for environmental causes. In the United States, one such advocate is the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA. Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA was established in 1970 following a series of environmental problems in the United States and in response to the federal government's inability to regulate environmental impacts. President Richard Nixon established the EPA as a regulatory body to enforce environmental policy. In a message sent to the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate, Nixon outlined that the EPA was established to develop and enforce environmental protection standards consistent with national goals. In addition, the EPA was to conduct research that was both general and specific. For example, in the case of pollution, general research would investigate the adverse effects of pollution, while specific research would investigate the impact of a specific polluter on a specific population in a specific city. Thus, the EPA is both an enforcement agency and a research agency. The EPA's current strategic plan includes five goals. Goal 1, address climate change and improve air quality. Goal 2, protect America's waters. Goal 3, clean up communities and advance sustainable development. Goal 4, ensure the safety of chemicals and preventing pollution. Goal 5, protect human health and the environment by enforcing laws and assuring compliance. Note the difference between the EPA's approach, which involves regulation, and the ICLEI's approach, which involves collaboration. The EPA has a long list of regulations for corporations and operates on the premise that compliance with legal regulations requires oversight, fines, and sometimes enforced compliance. In contrast, the ICLEI approach is more in line with the communitarian philosophy of working together to build resilient communities. Both the ICLEI and the EPA have been the focus of criticism about the value and appropriate limits of government regulation. Criticism has come from moderates and extremists, depending on the issue. While some have described the ICLEI as a toothless tiger, unable to enforce anything, others have accused the EPA of mission creep and overreach. Criticism from the National Review and similar entities suggests the EPA has strayed from its original mission. As one critic has put it, over most of its 40-year history, the EPA has strengthened environmental standards in a relatively incremental manner, allowing some measure of balance between environmental and economic needs. Using this strategy, the agency has effected much genuine environmental improvement. But for today's EPA, no economic impact is too onerous. The agency is issuing edicts of unprecedented scope at breakneck speed and with little justification and few identified benefits. An example of possible EPA overreach may be activities like the Partnership for Sustainable Communities. This is a collaboration between the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, the U.S. Department of Transportation, and the EPA. The three agencies collaborate with the goal of supporting environmental justice and equitable development in neighborhoods and regions. Some critics fear that three governmental agencies collaborating will curtail private sector efforts to make a profit in the housing and real estate marketplace. While the goals of such an effort might be notable, the application of policy and regulation toward those goals might indeed be overly economically limiting to communities and corporations. While different stakeholders may disagree about the appropriate scope and reach of such agencies, the fact remains that the agency's mandates must be taken into account when managers consider environmental and other CSR issues. European Union Environmental Policy. Following the formation of the EPA in 1970, the European Economic Community began holding summit meetings in Paris that resulted in a declaration on environmental and consumer protection. At the time, European nations were independent in terms of currency, regulations, and lawmaking. As such, most were notorious for not working together, despite the relatively small size and close proximity of European nations. However, European countries were also experiencing rapid expanse of industry and growing concern over the impact of environmental pollution. Among the various countries of Europe, there were vastly different standards for vehicle emissions, the lead content of gasoline, and the use of pesticides. In addition, political movements such as the Green Party in Germany pointed out that pollution does not stay within human-made borders, and some activists threatened political action if one country's pollution spread to another country without reparations or other compensatory action. As a result, the EU inherited significant environmental regulation and enforcement abilities from the constituent countries that had strong regulations when they were independent. The EU is considered to have some of the most extensive environmental laws of any government. For some, this fact indicates positive progress for CSR goals. For others, it makes the EU a less appealing place to establish new business. The EU's environmental policies are intertwined with the international and national environmental policies in its member nations and have had significant effects on its member states. The EU's environmental legislation addresses core issues that include acid rain, the ozone layer, air quality, noise pollution, waste, and water pollution. The Institute for European Environmental Policy estimates the body of EU environmental law amounts to well over 500 directives, regulations, and decisions. For example, the EU has taken dramatic steps to reduce waste in all member countries. This includes regulating recycling, prohibiting the discharge of wastewater, and regulating production processes so they do not produce waste. The Waste Framework Directive, WFD, is a regulation passed by the EU in June 2008 that hopes to turn the EU into a recycling society. One of the unique and compelling features of the WFD is the European Waste Hierarchy, which classifies the waste production and disposal system as follows. Step 1. Prevention. Preventing and reducing waste generation. Step 2. Reuse and preparation for reuse. Giving the products a second life before they become waste. Step 3. Recycle. Any recovery operation by which waste materials are reprocessed into products, materials, or substances, whether for the original or other purposes. It includes composting, and it does not include incineration. Step 4. Recovery. Some waste incineration, burning, ideally in a situation that works to eliminate or replace less inefficient incinerators. Step 5. Disposal. Processes to dispose of waste including landfilling, incineration, pyrolysis, gasification, and other finalist solutions. The European waste hierarchy suggests that prevention is the most important step because it prevents waste in the first place. Therefore, this step investigates and helps determine the market need for a product in order to ascertain whether it should be made and which resources should be used in the process. The hierarchy then suggests that if the product is made, the manufacturing process should be lean and result in as little waste as possible. The hierarchy further suggests that waste, once generated, should be reused or prepared for reuse. If that is not obtainable, it should be recycled. However, some waste cannot be recycled or reused, and so it is incinerated. This is defined as recovery. The least desirable step is the fifth step in the hierarchy, which is to dispose of waste in a landfill. International organizations and non-governmental organizations. The previous sections described the creation of government regulatory bodies that enforce environmental regulations. Before the creation of the ICLEI, the EPA, and the European Environmental Regulations, the Sierra Club, formed in 1882, represented one of the first collectives created explicitly to advocate for environmental preservation. The Sierra Club is an example of a non-governmental organization, NGO, which is an organization that is not part of a government nor funded by governments, foundations, schools, or businesses. Since the formation of the Sierra Club, other NGOs with similar focuses have emerged, and each organization differs in the level of political and social extremism it espouses. Organizations such as Earth First, Greenpeace, the Audubon Society, and many others exert differential levels of local and international influence. Green Party. The world's first political parties to adopt environmental platforms were the Tasmania Group in Tasmania, Australia, and the Values Party of New Zealand. The Popular Movement for the Environment, founded by the Green Party in Europe in 1972, has captured voter attention since its inception. The first national Green Party in Europe was founded in Britain and called the Ecology Party, which later became formally known as the Green Party. In India, the Chipko movement, formed by Mohandas Gandhi, featured the act of hugging trees to protest deforestation, which led to the term tree huggers. Peaceful methods of protest and the slogan "Ecology is permanent economy" were very influential in India and elsewhere thereafter. This list of organizations indicates the wide geographic range of environmental issues and emphasizes their long-standing historical and political roots. Contemporary leaders and consumers can use this knowledge to jumpstart conversations around the environment. As a result, business leaders can become better informed about the contexts in which they make decisions as they work for a more sustainable future. Environmentalism and CSR. In 2015, a haze settled over the western part of the United States. It came from wildfires in Asia, specifically Indonesia. Indeed, the United States routinely absorbs pollution from China. It has also experienced moderate increases in radioactivity following nuclear weapons testing or nuclear reactor accidents, such as the one that followed a 2011 earthquake in Japan and a 1986 reactor meltdown in the former Soviet Union. Global warming, the ozone layer, air pollution, and other large-scale environmental issues may cause international, social, and military conflict in the future, as people come to realize that we are all part of one global community. Such reports illustrate how pollution does not stop at national borders. However, it is most likely that future environmental conflict will not be centered on these issues, but rather on the problem of water. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, reports that at least 30 nations will be water scarce by 2025, up from 20 in 1990. 18 of the 30 are in the Middle East and North Africa, including Egypt, Israel, Somalia, Libya, and Yemen. As an example of how and why water issues relate to food security and national security, consider the fact that some political analysts see the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis as partially a fight over water and water resources, as well as a cultural or religious war. Adele Darwish, journalist and co-author of Water Wars, Coming Conflicts in the Middle East, suggests that modern history has already seen such wars. I have former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon speaking on record saying the reason for going to war against Arab armies in 1967 was for water. The OECD further supports the idea that water shortages enhance the impact of climate change and other kinds of pollution. Fundamentally, these are issues of poverty and inequality, man-made problems. These findings suggest that environmental issues are critical strategic concerns for consumers, citizens, governments, communities, and corporations. Achieving a balance between corporate activity and environmental impact poses an ongoing question for all communities and generations. The right policy may never exist or achieve perfect balance, yet failing to consider or create policy certainly offers a non-viable path. Leaders interested in sustainability and CSR can address environmental concerns by actively creating and inviting others to participate in ongoing conversations and strategy sessions. Doing so can have positive outcomes on the present, lay the foundation for longer-term impacts, and in many cases, contribute to a strong personal legacy. For example, consider how at the mouth of a granite canyon in Yosemite National Park, one can find a bust of Stephen Mather, the founder of the National Park Service. The monument depicts a simple likeness of his face, with his name and lifespan, and memorable words about the impact of his work, which involved protecting unique natural wonders found in the United States. Under the statue, it simply says, "The good he has done will never die." With strategic intent and active policies that unite or at least include constituents from many sectors, the same can be said for responsible corporate leaders who avoid taking environmental shortcuts. Indeed, history will remember those who carefully examine processes, products, waste, and other factors required to create a sustainable organization in the context of a sustainable environment. Chapter summary. This chapter examined the role of a corporate fiduciary and contrasted the role with that of a steward who accepts responsibility for sustainability, financial and otherwise. Stewardship involves listening and weighing multiple interests beyond short-term financial ones. The case of Atlas Minerals was discussed to highlight how ultimate organizational failure on stewardship results in government bailouts and irreversible damage to the environment and human health. Leaders can use several tools to combat negative outcomes, including the cradle-to-grave, cradle-to-cradle, and LCA approaches. When individuals and firms use analysis tools to widen the conversation about sustainability and social responsibility, they can achieve goals that are more closely aligned with those of the green movement. Creating a cooperative culture can help address environmental concerns, provide resources, and preserve nature for future generations. Critical thinking questions. 1. How does the idea of stewardship change or challenge your ideas about leadership in contemporary corporations? Where have you seen good examples of stewardship? 2. Is it possible to have environmental regulations that enhance economic opportunity rather than limit it? Provide examples that support your response. 3. What are some of the environmental impacts you might find if you did an LCA of A. the oil used in your car engine, B. a plastic soda bottle, C. a printed newspaper? 4. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency was formed to regulate and control pollution and prevent environmental harm. What are some of the challenges the EPA faces when it works within states? What about within the global environment? What strategies might you suggest to address these challenges? 5. Consider your personal behaviors and list some that you might change to positively impact the environment. What are some challenges you might face in changing these behaviors? How would you encourage others to adopt similar behaviors? 6. Consider current events and discuss how local and global water issues relate to CSR and/or security concerns. End of chapter 6.